Welcome back to the Expert Witness Playbook. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Kenny Stein, a physician who has spent nearly three decades practicing at the intersection of emergency medicine and critical care medicine. For the past 27 years, Dr. Stein has cared for critically ill and injured patients in some of the most demanding environments in healthcare. His experience spans the full spectrum of emergency and critical care, providing him with a unique perspective on acute medical decision-making, patient outcomes, and standard of care. In addition to his clinical practice, Dr. Stein has served as a medical expert witness for 24 years. His expertise has been sought in cases involving emergency medicine, critical care medicine, internal medicine, personal injury, nursing home care, and wrongful death. Over the course of his expert witness career, he has testified more than 300 times in deposition and at trial. Today, we'll discuss Dr. Stein's path into medical expert witness work, lessons learned from hundreds of cases and testimonies, and what attorneys and experts alike can learn from his extensive experience in both medicine and the courtroom. Dr. Stein, welcome to the Expert Witness Playbook.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me here.
Oh, this is great. I know we recently met and had a chance to chat, and you gave me all these different ideas of things that you could talk about. And one of the things that really sort of interested me was the ALI restatement of law. And we'll kind of get into that. But first, I want you to just kind of, for the audience, you know, we've got a lot of different audience members from a lot of different fields, but I think it's always helpful to spend the first couple of minutes just talk about kind of what got you into medicine and more specifically kind of your path into expert witness work.
Sure. So background, back in high school, I was a competitive gymnast and was always interested in anatomy and how the body works in various ways. And I was also interested in marine biology. So originally I was thinking I was going to be a marine biologist. And then I was thinking I was going to be an exercise physiologist, but then found out that was mostly dealing with how glucose is brought into cells during exercise and rest. And I was like, I need something a bit more person related. So fast forward to junior year in college, I'm on winter break in Florida with my family, and my older brother asked me questions that only an older brother can ask you. So, Kenny, what are you going to do after you graduate? I said, I'm going to go to graduate school. Why are you going to go to graduate school? I'm going to get a PhD. Why do you want to get a PhD? I don't know. Do you want to do research? I don't know. Do you want to teach? I don't know. And he says, well, you ever think about being a doctor? I was like, nah, I don't want to deal with all those pre-med types. And I'd already taken all the pre-med requisites by that point. So I'm going back to college. I'm on the bus from the airport to downtown Portland, Oregon, to catch the bus down to Eugene. And I'm looking out the window. I said, you know what? Maybe I'll be a doctor. And they had a wonderful program called Asclepiads, where you can go and go on rounds with doctors as an undergrad student, getting a feel for it. I said, this looks pretty darn interesting. And the orthopedist I was rounding with and going to see surgeries with said, he was a graduate student and he was in engineering. He said, you know, I could get a PhD in engineering or I can get an MD. And if I get an MD, I could always still do research. But if you only get a PhD, you can't treat patients. So he got his MD, decided let's go into orthopedic medicine. And he loved it anyway.
Oh, the best of both worlds there. Yeah.
So ended up going into med school at Vanderbilt, graduated, started residency in internal medicine, which is what I completed my residency in. Decided I did not really want to wear a suit and tie. I'm wearing a tie now in honor of this presentation, but much prefer the lifestyle of emergency medicine. You can go to work in your sweatpants and then put on your scrubs and then put on your sweatpants when you leave work.
I love that.
Yeah, and also no office hours, not having to take calls. But it is a fast-paced life in the ER. Because I had experience in critical care, was able to do ER and critical care, was able to get board certified in emergency medicine and in neurocritical care, went from working full-time ER to transitioning to doing ER and critical care. The latter part of my career, vast majority, was critical care, but still doing some emergency medicine.
Awesome. And then how far into your kind of clinical practice did you kind of get into expert witness work? Were you actively pursuing that at that point, or did a case just sort of stumble into your lap, or what sort of happened?
Yeah, there were a couple of things. It was about 8 years in, 8 or 10 years in to practice when I first started doing expert work. I had three colleagues, actually, who were doing some expert witness work. And two things happened very close proximity. One, in the ED, and one of my colleagues said, "Hey, Kenny, a defense lawyer called me about a case. I'm too busy to take it. Would you be interested in taking it?" And I said, "Sure." And another law firm from our neighboring state, Illinois, just found my name as a registered physician and said, "Hey, we have a case here. Would you be willing to review it?" So I got those first two cases. And then I said, you know, if I'm going to do this and learn how to do this and do it properly and correctly, I really should get some training. And Seek, who's very well known in the expert witness field.
Absolutely. They're really well known for both training and their directory.
And they had a wonderful training course on, one, how to protect yourself as a practicing physician from medical malpractice cases. And two, how to be an ethical and professional expert witness. So I took both of those cases, or both those courses, and the rest is history.
So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, because I don't know much about it, is the ALI Restatement of Law Third Malpractice. Kind of, first of all, what is ALI? Let's talk about what is ALI, and then maybe we can dig in a little bit more into this specific document.
Of course. So the ALI is the American Law Institute, and the ALI is a group of attorneys, law professors, members of government agencies who get together and they look at an area of law. In this case, it was torts, and specifically within torts, it's malpractice law. And they look at, since their last restatement, and why they call it Restatement of Law Third as opposed to the Third Restatement of Law, I don't know. But the previous restatement was the second restatement, and that took about 14 years to do that complete restatement. And that finished back in the 1970s, so about 40 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And what they do is they look over the whole field of medical malpractice litigation, laws around the country, court precedents, changes in medicine, and they come up with their recommendations as to various aspects of medical malpractice, both the standard of care, national standard versus local standard, clinical judgment, various other areas, and they give their opinions and they support it by precedents and laws around the country. Now, the ALI recommendations are recommendations. It's their opinions, their restatement. It is not law. Over years and years, parts of the ALI restatements may become law or may not. Some states may accept them, some states may not. Some restatements in various areas over the years have become very widely accepted. Others have not. My apologies. As to exactly how these restatements will become incorporated over the years, only time will tell.
I think one of the things, like, this is related to standard of care. I think our audience, you know, when we talk about standard of care, one of the most important things is always talking first to the retaining physician, the physician who has retained you, if they're asking for
an attorney.
Yeah, the retaining attorney. I mean, the attorney who has, not the physician, but the attorney who has retained you. Ask them specifically, what is the law language related to standard of care for their jurisdiction? I think right. I cannot, impress upon people that we're going to talk a lot about this ALI, but what really comes down to, there may be some nuances in that specific jurisdiction that you need to know about. So you always want to be asking that. I think I just want to make sure our audience is aware of that.
Oh, yeah. Every state, every jurisdiction has their own definition. Some are very similar, some are different. The ALI's recommendation, for one, is that when care is evaluated, it should be evaluated based upon a national standard of care. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that everyone in the nation practices exactly the same for every case. It's always case specific. For that case, in that situation, that patient with their constellation of medical problems and medicines that they're on and prior surgeries and such at that facility. When they talk about national standard of care, what they mean is that if you're at a level one trauma center in Los Angeles or New York or Michigan or Miami, and you have the exact same patient in any of those circumstances, the standard of care should be the same as long as the facilities are comparable and the capabilities are comparable. There may be some local laws that may modify that somewhat. A big one these days deal with gender health care and pregnancy-related care. So laws may change how the standard of care is applied to that situation. Likewise, if you're in a rural hospital, a critical access hospital, you should be comparing it to other critical access hospitals, whether it's in Tennessee or Alaska or Florida, once again, looking at what their capabilities are.
This is specifically what ALI is advocating for, because it's interesting. I was in a case in North Carolina, I don't often talk about standard of care, but I did. And there was some very specific, like, do you know what town this is? Do you know the demographics of this specific town? Do you tell me about what you know about this specific hospital and what happens in this specific region? So they were very, it was in North Carolina, it was very regionally based. And I'm sure you run into that.
Correct. And there's a mix. Sometimes yep. attorneys will ask you that just to bring up information that they can then present to the jury, saying, well, they're not very familiar with our state or region. That may be separate from what the court requires as far as defining the standard of care. For example, okay. if you're looking at Tennessee, they use a local standard of care. Not only do you have to be familiar with the standard of care in that community or a comparable community, but you can only be an expert in the case in Tennessee if you practice in Tennessee or in a surrounding state. There's some talk that they may change that, but currently that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
If
Absolutely.
You're in Illinois, it's what would a reasonably competent physician do in the same or similar circumstances, and you can be practicing anywhere. And in Tennessee, it will come up. Tell us about the demographics of the community. How large is the county? How large is the city? How many bed hospital? What level trauma center is it? And it's always important as an expert to make sure that you ask your attorney to provide you with the appropriate information. So I went online and I looked up information about a case and about the hospital and about the size of the hospital and everything. And I'm at deposition, and the attorney did not give me the information that was needed, which was, well, this case took place in 2020. Our deposition is in 2025. In between that five-year period, they tore down the old hospital, built a new hospital, and all the information I was looking at was for the new hospital. So it's always important to check with your attorney for that information. And even if it's not required by the standard of care, by the state's regulations, it's very helpful to know about how big the community is, the size of the hospitals, their capability. If it's a case of a burn, do they have a burn center? Do they need a fly out? Do they have an orthopedist or a vascular surgeon on site? do they need to transfer?
Okay. Yeah, no, it's because there are always different tactics that can be used in cross-examination to try to get you back on your heels, right?
Yep.
Make it, even if it's not needed, to make you, you know, and that's the job of the person examining. See where your vulnerabilities are, see where you may not be completely confident, and to shake your confidence.
Oh, yeah.
That is, yeah. And so back on to the ALI, and as far as, so what are kind of broad ALI, the restatement, sort of what does it say? Because I've kind of reviewed it, and I found some key principles related to, like, the medical customs remain important, evidence medicine can be considered,
sure.
It's competence, not perfection. But you're the expert that understands. I've just kind of read through this once and kind of gleaned some nuggets, but sure. you live and breathe this document.
I'll give you my thoughts as a physician. As an expert witness, definitely not as an attorney. Many of the cases currently, or standards of care currently, revolve around what a reasonable physician would do or would not do in that same situation. So what is usually done? And the current recommendations from the ALI is not just to look at what's currently done, because medicine changes, medicine evolves, but to look at what would be considered competent. So there might be different ways to look at the same situation and to do things. And even though one particular way may be the most common, there may be some alternatives that may be just as good, even though they're not the choice that most physicians would make. As long as a reasonable expert looking at it would say, yeah, that's competent. So let me just give an outlandish example comparing it to fishing. You can go fishing for bass or northern pike up there in Michigan. And you could say, well, I'm going to fish with live bait or I'm going to fish with lures, artificials. And both of those are acceptable. Some people prefer one, some people prefer the other. If you say, well, I'm going to take a gallon of cyanide and pour it in the lake and then just, use a net and get whatever floats up to the surface, that would not be considered competent. So you can have respectable minorities. You can have two schools or more schools of thought as long as it's viewed as being competent. That's okay. One of the big statements that they have.
Yeah. So competent. You know, I think that's the thing that I think new people really get caught up in. It is this whole idea that it's competence, not perfection. It's most of the time it's a lower bar than most of us hold ourselves to, right?
Exactly.
As physicians, we kind of hold ourselves to a higher bar, but it's not usually that bar.
Correct. There's also the term standard. And some people think of when they hear the term standard of care, their mind automatically thinks gold standard, what would be done at Mayo or Harvard, or Stanford, something of that nature. And that is a goal that is outstanding. That is excellent care, which is something to be strived for, but it's not required. The standard of care doesn't even have to be average. It can be a bit below average. And that kind of ruffles the feathers of a lot of physicians because they're like, well, if it's less than average, that can't be acceptable. But if you think about it, it kind of has to be. Why do I say that? If you say anything that is below that average line is beneath the standard of care, that automatically means that 49% of all medical care is negligent and breaches the standard of care. It's what is often referred to as a minimally acceptable bar. It doesn't have to be great. It doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be competent. and something that people would.
One of the analogies that as physicians who have taken a lot of tests and exams over the years, you know, this is A, B, C, D failure. So just like on a test, you can fail it. That is below the standard of care, but you could get a D and pass. You could get a C and pass. That's average. C is, or at least it used to be before grade inflation. A B and an A. We all want to get A's, but A, B, C, and D are all passing. Would you agree that would be a decent analogy, or would you use something different,
that'd
Kenny?
That'd be very reasonable. Another one that I like is if you think of restaurants, and there's all different qualities of restaurants, and some are excellent, and some you may think of, well, wasn't the cleanest, but, you know, it was okay. Restaurants have to pass a state health inspection. So the standard of care, if you're looking at restaurants, it doesn't have to be a Michelin 2-star level restaurant. It just has to pass the state health inspection. Same with the standard of care. It doesn't have to be excellent. It has to be above that minimally acceptable bar. So I totally agree with your analogy.
Yeah. So we kind of talk about, you know, I think you've touched base on kind of the medical custom is important. So evidence that a physician followed the common practice, and that customary practice, also the opposite, the customary practice may be negligent if it was unreasonable or unsupported by evidence, right?
Sure. And it's also that things change with time. For example, about 30 years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, it became common practice based on limited studies to give high dose steroids to people with spinal cord trauma, that it would improve their chances of a good outcome. And what they found over years and years of doing that is that at most, it would, or in general, it would improve you by about one level, vertebral level of improvement in the spinal cord injury. But at a high risk of complications from high-dose steroids, which include increased risk of infection, worse wound healing, and gastrointestinal bleeds. So although that was the standard of care previously for many cases, it's no longer considered the usual customary practice of high-dose steroids. Same for blood transfusions. When I was in med school, and I would guess when you were, it was, transfused to a hemoglobin of 30, excuse me, a hemoglobin of 10, hematocrit of 30. Now, for many cases in an otherwise stable patient, it's okay to go with a hemoglobin of 7. And if they have some underlying cardiac disease, maybe a hemoglobin of 8. But things change with time. So you have to look at what's considered competent, and you also have to look at the time frame. I have cases that are still pending from 9 years ago. So you have to look at what was common, reasonable, acceptable practice 9 years ago.
So Kenny, how should people incorporate evidence-based medicine? How should they consider that? Whether they're clinical guidelines, systematic reviews, or high-quality scientific evidence, how should that be incorporated into a standard of care analysis?
In some circumstances, not all circumstances, you can try and find guidelines that may apply to that situation. One of the problems with guidelines, let's say, for example, the American Heart Association, guidelines for management of acute coronary syndrome. And what they'll say right in the guideline is these guidelines are useful recommendations for patients in most, but not all circumstances. And you may have guidelines that conflict with each other. For example, there are most likely about 20 different organizations, many of which are reputable, that will have differing opinions as to how to treat pneumonia. What the ALI is stating is that using a guideline can help support. It can add evidence that a physician was practicing within the standard of care because a guideline recommended it. There are other organizations that say, well, you can't rely too much on guidelines because there's all these competing guidelines. And sometimes the organizations say gastroenterology, that they're saying, how long is it acceptable to wait after a patient comes in with an upper GI bleed until you do an endoscopy? And they may write their recommendations, say, well, it's reasonable to wait for 24 hours. So I'm just throwing that number out. That's not what a guideline says. So they're writing their own guidelines that are going to be supervising or be used to judge physicians in their area. So they may tilt the guidelines the way they're written to the advantage of the practitioners in that field. So there's different thoughts as to how much reliance there should be on guidelines. Plus, there will not be guidelines for every area. And what do you do if they're conflicting guidelines? So it's helpful to look for guidelines. Many times attorneys would like there to be some citations in an expert report to overcome a Daubert challenge as to how they came up with that opinion. But there are numerous different places to look, and especially now with openevidence.com, which many physicians are using, you can look there. But whatever open evidence or any AI program you're using, when it brings up a quote, go to the source, go to the article.
Oh, absolutely.
Make sure it's appropriate. So I've done ones looking for geriatric patients and open evidence for a certain topic, and it brings up a pediatric article. So you have to actually look at the article, make sure it's appropriate and relevant to how you're going to be to the case in front of you.
I know this document also, as I was going through, contains sections addressing informed consent duties and exceptions. I don't know if you've had a chance to study that part and how that may relate to things. I know that that comes up at times, informed consent and proper informed consent and all of that.
Yeah, there's some contentious areas in that, in the way they've worded it. My understanding of that area was not the area I focused on as much.
Okay.
But was that they are recommending not to say what a reasonable patient would have done in the same situation if they had been asked to obtain informed consent, but what that particular patient would have done if they were asked.
Okay.
And it comes up because sometimes you don't always have the availability of family. A patient might be altered mental status. They may be on a ventilator. You don't have family nearby. You don't have somebody you can get informed consent from. So those can get somewhat tricky. Other areas that come up is that many courts, although nowadays it's a bit fewer, have a recommendation in jury instructions that as long as the doctor was using clinical judgment, that term, clinical judgment, that you cannot fault them because they were using clinical judgment, meaning, well, they were trying to do the best they can. Well, the patient came in and they had an x-ray that showed an obvious osteosarcoma of their left femur, and they accidentally amputated the right leg, but they used their clinical judgment. That's an outlandish example.
Yeah.
But very often at depositions, the opposing attorney will say, well, doctor, weren't they just using their clinical judgment, trying to use it as a get-out-of-jail-free card? The American Law Institute is recommending that they no longer use that clinical judgment recommendation, that it's the care that was actually provided, even if the physician was trying to do the right thing, if they really breached the standard of care and did something obviously inappropriate and incorrect, that you look at the care that was provided, not just their intentions.
Yeah, I think I came across that, and I've never taken a Latin class in my life, but I think it was res ipsa locutor.
It's for itself.
Yeah, and where that restatement addressed situations where negligence may be inferred from the nature of the event itself, like you said, a wrong side surgery or a retained foreign body or something like that, where it's pretty darn clear that something went wrong.
And that comes up to the topic of expert witnesses. So in many cases, in standard negligence, so outside of medical malpractice, they don't need an expert to come in. For example, if someone has their garden hose going across their sidewalk in front of their house and someone trips on it, the average juror, it's felt, would be able to interpret and say, yeah, that was negligent. That was the wrong thing to do. Whereas in medicine, it's felt that for most cases, things have such a nuance to it that you need a physician expert, a medical expert, to come in and explain things. The ALI recommendations restatement gives an example and says sometimes things are so blatant that you don't need to have an expert. And the example that they cite is a patient is in labor, screaming in pain, having significant bleeding, and the obstetrician, knowing this, signs out and leaves the hospital. And in a case like that, it's felt that it's so obvious, res ipsa, it speaks for itself, that the jury may be able, if the judge feels appropriate, may be able to judge that there was negligence, even without an expert.
So, you know, when I, in the rare cases, I do mostly causation and damages, but in the rare cases of standard of care, I'm going to read kind of what grounds me and kind of how I look at it. And it's the standard of care is the care, skill, and knowledge regarded as competent among similarly situated physicians practicing under similar circumstances. In forming my opinions, I consider the medical records, the applicable literature, the published guidelines, and the clinical circumstances present at the time of care. I think that kind of incorporates most of what we talked about today, kind of thinking about, you know, that sort of the timing. I think it's really important. You brought up that timing where you may be brought into a case now, and some of these cases could be 10, 15 years old when they're pediatric cases, because there's no, you know, the time doesn't run out on a lot of these.
Sure.
So I know we're getting towards the end of our time, Kenny, and this has been super helpful for me to kind of think about this, and I'm sure our audience it's going to sort of drive some thought and probably some further conversations down the road. I'd love to have you back. I feel like we just started to scratch the surface. I always want to have my guests leave with sort of what is something you just want to make sure you reinforce, something maybe you haven't brought up before we wrap things up with the audience, that you think are, you know, you want to make sure people understand or aren't confused about.
Right. It's always hard as an expert. We always get accused of Monday morning quarterbacking of, well, you already know what the outcome was, and you're going back and saying what should have been done. So always try and look at it as best as you can from the perspective of what was known or what could have been known at that time, if proper questions were asked, and to look at it from that situation in that hospital with those facilities with that patient.
Try to put yourself in their shoes, walk in their shoes. Correct. Kind of imagining yourself in that moment by moment, what was going on is I think what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
Well, once again, another great conversation with Dr. Kenny Stein, and this has been, I've learned a lot. These podcasts, I feel like I'm always learning things, and I hope you are too. For those of you out there in the audience, one of the most important things that we love is that you like, you comment, you reach out. Kenny, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's your email address? We'll have it put up here. How would somebody be able to get in touch with you?
Sure. Two ways. My ER, luckily I was able to get my website very early in the days of the internet. It's er-md.com. So kennystein@md.com. Email is kennystein and the number one. So kennystein1@gmail.com. And thank you so much for having me on as a guest today.
Oh, this was it's all my pleasure. And I look forward to us getting another chance to chat again. Signing off from Expert Witness Playbook, I appreciate everybody listening. Have a great day. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.